The five people sitting round the table seemed to find conversation difficult. Outside, sudden gusts of wind came up and died away. Vera shivered a little and said, "There is a storm coming." Blore made a contribution to the discourse. He said conversationally, "There was an old fellow in the train from Plymouth yesterday. He kept saying a storm was coming. Wonderful how they know the weather, these old salts." Rogers went round the table collecting the meat plates. Suddenly, with the plates held in his hands, he stopped. He said in an odd, scared voice, "There's somebody running." They could all hear it, running feet along the terrace. In that minute, they knew. Knew without being told. As by common accord, they all rose to their feet. They stood looking towards the door. Dr. Armstrong appeared, his breath coming fast. He said, "General MacArthur! Dead!" The voice burst from Vera explosively. Armstrong said, "Yes. He's dead." There was a pause, a long pause. Seven people looked at each other and could find no words to say. The storm broke just as the old man's body was borne in through the door. The others were standing in the hall. There was a sudden hiss and roar as the rain came down. As Blore and Armstrong passed up the stairs with their burden, Vera Claythorne turned suddenly and went into the deserted dining-room. It was as they had left it. The sweet course stood ready on the sideboard, untasted. Vera went up to the table. She was there a minute or two later when Rogers came softly into the room. He started when he saw her. Then his eyes asked a question. He said, "Oh, miss, I just came to see—" In a loud, harsh voice that surprised herself, Vera said, "You're quite right, Rogers. Look for yourself. There are only seven." General MacArthur had been laid on his bed. After making a last examination, Armstrong left the room and came downstairs. He found the others assembled in the drawing-room. Miss Brent was knitting. Vera Claythorne was standing by the window, looking out at the hissing rain. Blore was sitting squarely in a chair, his hands on his knees. Lombard was walking restlessly up and down. At the far end of the room, Mr. Justice Wargrave was sitting in a grandfather chair. His eyes were half closed. They opened as the doctor came into the room. He said in a clear, penetrating voice, "Well, doctor?" Armstrong was very pale. He said, "No question of heart failure or anything like that. MacArthur was hit with a life preserver or some such thing on the back of the head." A little murmur went round, but the clear voice of the judge was raised once more. "Did you find the actual weapon used?" "No. Nevertheless, you are sure of your facts?" "I am quite sure," Mr. Justice Wargrave said quietly. "We know now exactly where we are." There was no doubt now who was in charge of the situation. This morning, Wargrave had sat huddled in his chair on the terrace, refraining from any overt activity. Now he assumed command with the ease born of a long habit of authority. He definitely presided over the court. Clearing his throat, he once more spoke. "This morning, gentlemen, whilst I was sitting on the terrace, I was an observer of your activities. There could be little doubt of your purpose. You were searching the island for an unknown murderer."
"Quite right, sir," said Philip Lombard. The judge went on.
"You had come, doubtless, to the same conclusion that I had, namely that the deaths of Anthony Marston and Mrs. Rogers were neither accidental, nor were they suicides. No doubt you also reached a certain conclusion as to the purpose of Mr. Owen in enticing us to this island." Blore said hoarsely, "He's a madman, a loony." The judge coughed. "That almost certainly, but it hardly affects the issue. Our main preoccupation is this, to save our lives." Armstrong said in a trembling voice, "There's no one on the island, I tell you, no one." The judge stroked his jaw. He said gently, "In the sense you mean, no. I came to that conclusion early this morning. I could have told you that your search would be fruitless. Nevertheless, I am strongly of the opinion that Mr. Owen, to give him the name he himself has adopted, is on the island. Very much so. Given the scheme in question, which is neither more nor less than the execution of justice upon certain individuals for offences which the law cannot touch, there is only one way in which that scheme could be accomplished. Mr. Owen could only come to the island in one way. It is perfectly clear. Mr. Owen is one of us.
Oh, no, no, no! It was Vera who burst out, almost in a moan. The judge turned a keen eye on her. He said, "My dear young lady, this is no time for refusing to look facts in the face. We are all in grave danger. One of us is U.N. Owen, and we do not know which of us. Of the 10 people who came to this island, 3 are definitely cleared. Anthony Marston, Mrs. Rogers, and General MacArthur have gone beyond suspicion. There are 7 of us left. Of those 7, 1 is, if I may so express myself, a bogus little Indian boy." He paused and looked round. "Do I take it that you all agree?" Armstrong said, "It's fantastic, but I suppose you're right." Blore said, "No doubt of it, if you ask me. I've a very good idea." A quick gesture of Mr. Justice Wargrave's hand stopped him. The judge said quietly, "We will come to that presently. At the moment, all I wish to establish is that we are in agreement on the facts." Emily Brent, still knitting, said, "Your argument seems logical. I agree that one of us is possessed by a devil." Vera murmured, "I can't believe it. I can't." Wargrave said, "Lombard?"
"I agree, sir. Absolutely."
The judge nodded his head in a satisfied manner. He said, "Now, let us examine the evidence. To begin with, is there any reason for suspecting one particular person? Mr. Blore, you have, I think, something to say." Blore was breathing hard. He said,
"Lombard's got a revolver. He didn't tell the truth last night. He admits it."
Philip Lombard smiled scornfully. He said,
"I suppose I'd better explain again."
He did so, telling the story briefly and succinctly. Blore said sharply,
"What's to prove it? There's nothing to corroborate your story?"
The judge coughed. "Unfortunately," he said, "we are all in that position. There is only our own word to go upon." He leaned forward. "You have none of you yet grasped what a very peculiar situation this is. To my mind, there is only one course of procedure to adopt. Is there anyone whom we can definitely eliminate from suspicion on the evidence which is in our possession?" Dr. Armstrong said quickly, "I'm a well-known professional man. The mere idea that I could be suspected of—" Again, a gesture of the judge's hand arrested a speaker before he finished his speech. Mr. Justice Wargrave said in his small, clear voice, "I, too, am a well-known person, but, my dear sir, that proves less than nothing. Doctors have gone mad before now. Judges have gone mad. So," he added, looking at Blore, "have policemen." Lombard said,
"Well, at any rate, I suppose you'll leave the women out of it."
The judge's eyebrows rose. He said, in the famous acid tone that counsel knew so well, "Do I understand you to assert that women are not subject to homicidal mania?" Lombard said irritably, "Well, of course not, but all the same, hardly seems possible." He stopped. Mr. Justice Wargrave, still in the same thin, sour voice, addressed Armstrong. "I take it, Dr. Armstrong, that a woman would have been physically capable of striking the blow that killed poor MacArthur?" The doctor said calmly, "Perfectly capable, given a suitable instrument, such as a rubber truncheon or cosh." "It would require no undue exertion of force?"
"Not at all."
Mr. Justice Wargrave wriggled his tortoise-like neck. He said, The other two deaths have resulted from the administration of drugs. That, no one will dispute, is easily compassed by a person of the smallest physical strength. Vera cried angrily. I think you're mad! His eyes turned slowly till they rested on her. It was the dispassionate stare of a man well used to weighing humanity in the balance. She thought, he's just seeing me as a specimen, and... The thought came to her with real surprise. He doesn't like me much. In measured tones, the judge was saying, My dear young lady, do try and restrain your feelings. I am not accusing you. He bowed to Miss Brent. I hope, Miss Brent, that you are not offended by my insistence that all of us are equally under suspicion. Emily Brent was knitting. She did not look up. In a cold voice she said, The idea that I should be accused of taking a fellow creature's life, not to speak of the lives of three fellow creatures, is, of course, quite absurd to anyone who knows anything of my character. But I quite appreciate the fact that we are all strangers to one another, and that in those circumstances nobody can be exonerated without the fullest proof. There is, as I have said, a devil amongst us. The judge said, Then we are agreed. There can be no elimination on the ground of character or position alone. Lombard said, What about Rogers? The judge looked at him unblinkingly. What about him? Lombard said, Well, to my mind, Rogers seems pretty well ruled out. Mr. Justice Wargrave said, Indeed, and on what grounds? Lombard said, He hasn't got the brains, for one thing, and for another, his wife was one of the victims. The judge's heavy eyebrows rose once more. He said, In my time, young man, several people have come before me accused of the murders of their wives and have been found guilty. Oh, I agree. Wife murder's perfectly possible, almost natural, let's say, but not this particular kind. I can believe in Rogers killing his wife because he was scared of her breaking down and giving him away, or because he'd taken a dislike to her, or because he wanted to link up with some nice little bit rather less long in the tooth. But I can't see him as the lunatic Mr. Owen, dealing out crazy justice and starting on his own wife for a crime they both committed. Mr. Justice Wargrave said, You are assuming hearsay to be evidence. We do not know that Rogers and his wife conspired to murder their employer. That may have been a false statement, made so that Rogers should appear to be in the same position as ourselves. Mrs. Rogers' terror last night may have been due to the fact that she realized her husband was mentally unhinged. Lombard said, Well, have it your own way. You and Owen is one of us. No exceptions allowed. We all qualify. Mr. Justice Wargrave said, My point is that there can be no exceptions allowed on the score of character, position, or probability. What we must now examine is the possibility of eliminating one or more persons on the facts. To put it simply, is there among us one or more persons who could not possibly have administered either cyanide to Anthony Marston or an overdose of sleeping draught to Mrs. Rogers, and who had no opportunity of striking the blow that killed General MacArthur? Blore's rather heavy face lit up. He leant forward. Now you're talking, sir, he said. That's the stuff. Let's go into it. As regards young Marston, I don't think there's anything to be done. It's already been suggested that someone from outside slipped something into the dregs of his glass before he refilled it for the last time. A person actually in the room could have done that even more easily. I can't remember if Rogers was in the room, but any of the rest of us could certainly have done it. He paused, then went on. Now, take the woman, Rogers. The people who stand out there are her husband and the doctor. Either of them could have done it as easy as winking. Armstrong sprang to his feet. He was trembling. I protest. This is absolutely uncalled for. I swear that the dose I gave the woman was perfectly... Dr. Armstrong! The small, sour voice was compelling. The doctor stopped with a jerk in the middle of his sentence. The small, cold voice went on. Your indignation is very natural. Nevertheless, you must admit that the facts have got to be faced. Either you or Rogers could have administered a fatal dose with the greatest ease. Let us now consider the position of the other people present. What chance had I? Had Inspector Blore? Had Miss Brent? Had Miss Claythorne? had Mr. Lombard of administering poison. Can any one of us be completely and entirely eliminated? He paused. I think not. Vera said angrily,
I was nowhere near the woman. All of you can swear to that.
Mr. Justice Wargrave waited a minute. Then he said, As far as my memory serves me, the facts were these. Will anyone please correct me if I make a misstatement? Mrs. Rogers was lifted onto the sofa by Anthony Marston and Mr. Lombard, and Dr. Armstrong went to her. He sent Rogers for brandy. There was then a question raised as to where the voice we had just heard had come from. We all went into the next room, with the exception of Miss Brent, who remained in this room, alone with the unconscious woman. A spot of colour came into Emily Brent's cheeks. She stopped knitting. She said, This is outrageous! The remorseless, small voice went on. When we returned to this room, you, Miss Brent, were bending over the woman on the sofa. Emily Brent said,
Is common humanity a criminal offence?
Mr. Justice Wargrave said, I am only establishing the facts. Rogers then entered the room with the brandy, which, of course, he could quite well have doctored before entering the room. The brandy was administered to the woman, and shortly afterwards her husband and Dr. Armstrong assisted her up to bed, where Dr. Armstrong gave her a sedative.
Bloor said, Well, that's what happened. Absolutely. And that lets out the judge, Mr. Lombard, myself, and Miss Claythorne.
His voice was loud and jubilant. Mr. Justice Wargrave, bringing a cold eye to bear upon him, murmured, Ah, but does it? We must take into account every possible eventuality. Bloor stared. He said,
I don't get you.
Mr. Justice Wargrave said, Upstairs in her room, Mrs. Rogers is lying in bed. The sedative that the doctor has given her begins to take effect. She is vaguely sleepy and acquiescent. Supposing that at that moment there is a tap on the door, and someone enters, bringing her, shall we say, a tablet or a draught, with the message that the doctor says you're to take this. Do you imagine for 1 minute that she would not have swallowed it obediently, without thinking twice about it? There was a silence. Bloor shifted his feet and frowned. Philip Lombard said,
I don't believe in that story for a minute. Besides, none of us left this room for hours afterwards. There was Marston's death and all the rest of it.
The judge said, Someone could have left his or her bedroom later.
Lombard objected, But then Rogers would have been up there.
Dr. Armstrong stirred. No, he said. Rogers went downstairs to clear up in the dining room and pantry. Anyone could have gone up to the woman's bedroom then without being seen. Emily Brent said, Surely, Doctor, the woman would have been fast asleep by then under the influence of the drug you had administered.
In all likelihood, yes, but it is not a certainty. Until you have prescribed for a patient more than once, you cannot tell their reaction to different drugs. There is sometimes a considerable period before a sedative takes effect. It depends on the personal idiosyncrasy of the patient towards that particular drug.
Lombard said, Well, of course, you would say that, Doctor. Suits your book, eh? Again Armstrong's face darkened with anger. But again that passionless, cold little voice stopped the words on his lips. No good result can come from recrimination. Facts are what we have to deal with. It is established, I think, that there is a possibility of such a thing as I have outlined occurring. I agree that its probability value is not high, though, there again, it depends on who that person might have been. The appearance of Miss Brent or of Miss Claythorne on such an errand would have occasioned no surprise in the patient's mind. I agree that the appearance of myself, or of Mr. Bloor, or of Mr. Lombard, could have been, to say the least of it, unusual. But I still think the visit would have been received without the awakening of any real suspicion. Bloor said, And that gets us where?
Mr. Justice Wargrave, stroking his lip and looking quite passionless and inhuman, said, We have now dealt with the second killing, and we have established the fact that no one of us can be completely exonerated from suspicion.
He paused and went on. We come now to the death of General MacArthur. That took place this morning. I will ask anyone who considers that he or she has an alibi to state it in so many words. I myself will state at once that I have no valid alibi. I spent the morning sitting on the terrace and meditating on the singular position in which we all find ourselves. I sat on that chair on the terrace for the whole morning, until the gong went. But there were, I should imagine, several periods during the morning when I was quite unobserved, and during which it would have been possible for me to walk down to the sea, kill the general, and return to my chair. There is only my word for the fact that I never left the terrace. In the circumstances, that is not enough. There must be proof. Bloor said, "Well, I was with Mr. Lombard and Dr. Armstrong all the morning. They'll bear me out." Dr. Armstrong said, "Oh, you went to the house for a rope." Bloor said, "Well, of course I did. Went straight there and straight back. You know I did." Armstrong said, "You were a long time." Bloor turned crimson. He said, "What the hell do you mean by that, Dr. Armstrong?" Armstrong repeated, "I only said you were a long time. Well, had to find you, didn't I? Can't lay your hands on a coil of rope all in a minute." Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "During Inspector Bloor's absence, were you two gentlemen together?" Armstrong said hotly, "Certainly. That is, Lombard went off for a few minutes. I remained where I was." Lombard said with a smile, "I wanted to test the possibilities of heliographing to the mainland. Wanted to find the best spot. I was only absent a minute or two." Armstrong nodded. He said, "That's right. Not long enough to do a murder, I assure you." The judge said, "Did either of you two glance at your watches?" "Well, no," Philip Lombard said. "I wasn't wearing one." The judge said evenly, "A minute or two is a vague expression." He turned his head to the upright figure with the knitting lying on her lap. "Miss Brent?" Emily Brent said, "I took a walk with Miss Claythorne up to the top of the island. Afterwards I sat on the terrace in the sun." The judge said, "I don't think I noticed you there." "No, I was round the corner of the house to the east. It was out of the wind there." "And you sat there till lunchtime?" "Yes." "Miss Claythorne?" Vera answered readily and clearly. "I was with Miss Brent early this morning. After that I wandered about a bit. Then I went down and talked to General MacArthur." Mr. Justice Wargrave interrupted. He said, "What time was that?" Vera, for the first time, was vague. She said, "Well, I don't know, about an hour before lunch, I think, or it might have been less." Bloor asked, "Was it after we'd spoken to him or before?" Vera said, "I don't know. He was very queer." She shivered. "In what way was he queer?" the judge wanted to know. Vera said in a low voice, "He said we were all going to die. He said he was waiting for the end. He frightened me." The judge nodded. He said, "What did you do next?" "I went back to the house. Then, just before lunch, I went out again and up behind the house. I've been terribly restless all day." Mr. Justice Wargrave stroked his chin. He said, "There remains Rogers, though I doubt if his evidence will add anything to our sum of knowledge." Rogers, summoned before the court, had very little to tell. He had been busy all the morning about household duties, and with the preparation of lunch. He had taken cocktails onto the terrace before lunch, and had then gone up to remove his things from the attic to another room. He had not looked out of the window during the morning, and had seen nothing that could have any bearing upon the death of General MacArthur. He would swear definitely that there had been 8 china figures upon the dining table when he laid the table for lunch. At the conclusion of Roger's evidence, there was a pause. Mr. Justice Wargrave cleared his throat. Lombard murmured to Vera Claythorne, "The summing up will now take place." The judge said, "We have inquired into the circumstances of these 3 deaths to the best of our ability. Whilst probability in some cases is against certain people being implicated, yet we cannot say definitely that any one person can be considered as cleared of all complicity. I reiterate my positive belief that of the seven persons assembled in this room, one is a dangerous and probably insane criminal. There is no evidence before us as to who that person is. All we can do at the present juncture is to consider what measures we can take for communicating with the mainland for help, and in the event of help being delayed, as is only too possible given the state of the weather, what measures we must adopt to ensure our safety. I would ask you all to consider this carefully and to give me any suggestions that may occur to you. In the meantime, I warn everybody to be upon his or her guard. So far, the murderer has had an easy task since his victims have been unsuspicious. From now on, it is our task to suspect each and every one amongst us. Forewarned is forearmed. Take no risks and be alert to danger. That is all. Philip Lombard murmured beneath his breath, "The court will now adjourn." Chapter 10. "Do you believe it?" Vera asked. She and Philip Lombard sat on the windowsill of the living room. Outside, the rain poured down and the wind howled in great shuddering gusts against the window panes. Philip Lombard cocked his head slightly on one side before answering. Then he said,
"Well, you mean, do I believe that old Wargrave is right when he says it's one of us?"
"Yes,"
Philip Lombard said slowly. "It's difficult to say. Logically, you know, he's right, and yet—"
Vera took the words out of his mouth.
"And yet it seems so incredible."
Philip Lombard made a grimace.
"Well, the whole thing's incredible. But after MacArthur's death, there's no more doubt as to one thing. There's no question now of accidents or suicides. It's definitely murder. Three murders up to date."
Vera shivered. She said, "It's like some awful dream. I keep feeling that things like this can't happen."
He said with understanding, "I know. Presently a tap will come on the door and early morning tea will be brought in."
Vera said, "Oh, how I wish that could happen."
Philip Lombard said gravely, "Yes, but it won't. We're all in the dream, and we've got to be pretty much upon our guard from now on."
Vera said, lowering her voice,
If it is one of them, which do you think it is?"
Philip Lombard grinned suddenly. He said,
"I take it you're accepting our two selves. Well, that's all right. I know very well that I'm not the murderer, and I don't fancy that there's anything insane about you, Vera. You strike me as being one of the sanest and most level-headed girls I've come across. I'd stake my reputation on your sanity."
With a slightly wry smile, Vera said, "Thank you."
He said, "Come now, Miss Vera Claythorne, aren't you going to return the compliment?"
Vera hesitated a minute. Then she said, "You've admitted, you know, that you don't hold human life particularly sacred. But all the same, I can't see you as the man who dictated that gramophone record."
Lombard said, "Quite right. If I were to commit one or more murders, it would be solely for what I could get out of them. This mass clearance isn't my line of country."
"Good.
Then we'll eliminate ourselves and concentrate on our five fellow prisoners. Which of them is UN Owen?"
"Well, at a guess, and with absolutely nothing to go upon, I'd plump for Wargrave."
"Oh!"
Vera sounded surprised. She thought a minute or two and then said, "Why?"
"Hard to say exactly. But to begin with, he's an old man, and he's been presiding over courts of law for years. That is to say, he's played God Almighty for a good many months every year. That must go to a man's head eventually. He gets to see himself as all-powerful, as holding the power of life and death, and it's possible that his brain might snap, and he might want to go one step farther and be executioner and judge extraordinary."
Vera said slowly, "Yes, I suppose that's possible."
Lombard said, "Who do you plump for?"
Without any hesitation, Vera answered, "Dr. Armstrong."
Lombard gave a low whistle.
"The doctor, eh? You know, I should have put him last of all."
Vera shook her head. "Oh, no. Two of the deaths have been poison. That rather points to a doctor. and then you can't get over the fact that the only thing we are absolutely certain Mrs. Rogers had was the sleeping draught that he gave her. Lombard admitted. Yes, that's true, Vera persisted. If a doctor went mad, it would be a long time before anyone suspected, and doctors overwork and have a lot of strain.
Philip Lombard said, Yes, but I doubt if he could have killed MacArthur. He wouldn't have had time during that brief interval when I left him. Not, that is, unless he fairly haired down there and back again, and I doubt if he's in good enough training to do that and show no signs of it.
Vera said, He didn't do it then. He had an opportunity later.
When?
When he went down to call the general to lunch.
Philip whistled again very softly.
He said, So, you think he did it then? Pretty cool thing to do.
Vera said impatiently, What risk was there? He's the only person here with medical knowledge. He can swear the body's been dead at least an hour, and who's to contradict him?
Philip looked at her thoughtfully.
You know, he said, that's a clever idea of yours. I wonder...
Who is it, Mr. Blore? That's what I want to know. Who is it?
Roger's face was working. His hands were clenched round the polishing leather that he held in his hand.
Ex-Inspector Blore said, Hey, my lad, that's the question.
One of us, his lordship said. Which one? That's what I want to know. Who's the fiend in human form?
That, said Blore, is what we would all like to know.
Rogers said shrewdly, But you've got an idea, Mr. Blore. You've got an idea, haven't you?
I may have an idea, said Blore slowly. But that's a long way from being sure. I may be wrong. All I can say is that if I'm right, the person in question is a very cool customer. A very cool customer indeed.
Rogers wiped the perspiration from his forehead. He said hoarsely,
It's like a bad dream, that's what it is.
Blore said, looking at him curiously,
Got any ideas yourself, Rogers?
The butler shook his head. He said hoarsely,
I don't know. I don't know at all, and that's what's frightening the life out of me, to have no idea.
Dr. Armstrong said violently, We must get out of here, we must, at all costs.
Mr. Justice Wargrave looked thoughtfully out of the smoking room window. He played with the cord of his eyeglasses. He said, I do not, of course, profess to be a weather prophet, but I should say that it is very unlikely that a boat could reach us, even if they knew of our plight, under 24 hours, and even then only if the wind drops.
Dr. Armstrong dropped his head in his hands and groaned. He said,
And in the meantime we may all be murdered in our beds.
I hope not, said Mr. Justice Wargrave. I intend to take every possible precaution against such a thing happening.
It flashed across Dr. Armstrong's mind that an old man like the judge was far more tenacious of life than a younger man would be. He had often marvelled at that fact in his professional career. Here was he, junior to the judge by perhaps 20 years, and yet with a vastly inferior sense of self-preservation. Mr. Justice Wargrave was thinking.
Murdered in our beds. These doctors are all the same. They think in clichés. A thoroughly commonplace mind.
The doctor said, There have been 3 victims already, remember.
Certainly, but you must remember that they were unprepared for the attack. We are forewarned.
Dr. Armstrong said bitterly,
What can we do?
Sooner or later,
I think, said Mr. Justice Wargrave, that there are several things we can do.
Armstrong said,
We've no idea even who it can be.
The judge stroked his chin and murmured,
Oh, you know, I wouldn't quite say that.
Armstrong stared at him.
Do you mean you know?
Mr. Justice Wargrave said cautiously,
As regards actual evidence, such as is necessary in court, I admit that I have none. But it appears to me, reviewing the whole business, that one particular person is sufficiently clearly indicated.
Yes, I think so.
Armstrong stared at him. He said,
I don't understand.
Miss Brent was upstairs in her bedroom. She took up her Bible
and went to sit by the window. She opened it. Then, after a minute's hesitation, she set it aside and went over to the dressing table. From a drawer in it, she took out a small black-covered notebook. She opened it and began writing. A terrible thing has happened. General MacArthur is dead. His cousin married Elsie MacPherson. There is no doubt but that he was murdered. After luncheon, the judge made us a most interesting speech. He is convinced that the murderer is one of us. That means that one of us is possessed by a devil. I had already suspected that. Which of us is it? They are all asking themselves that. I alone know. She sat for some time without moving. Her eyes grew vague and filmy. The pencil straggled drunkenly in her fingers. In shaking loose capitals, she wrote, "The murderer's name is Beatrice Taylor." Her eyes closed. Suddenly, with a start, she awoke. She looked down at the notebook. With an angry exclamation, she scored through the vague, unevenly scrawled characters of the last sentence. She said in a low voice, "Did I write that? Did I? I must be going mad." The storm increased. The wind howled against the side of the house. Everyone was in the living room. They sat listlessly huddled together, and surreptitiously they watched each other. When Rogers brought in the tea tray, they all jumped. He said, "Shall I draw the curtains? It would make it more cheerful-like." Receiving an assent to this, the curtains were drawn and the lamps turned on. The room grew more cheerful. A little of the shadow lifted. Surely by tomorrow the storm would be over and someone would come. A boat would arrive. Vera Claythorne said, "Will you pour out tea, Miss Brent?" The elder woman replied, "No, you do it, dear. The teapot is so heavy, and I've lost 2 skeins of my grey knitting wool. So annoying!" Vera moved to the tea-table. There was a cheerful rattle and clink of china. Normality returned. Tea. Blessed, ordinary, everyday afternoon tea. Philip Lombard made a cheery remark. Bloor responded, "Dr. Armstrong told a humorous story." Mr. Justice Wargrave, who ordinarily hated tea, sipped approvingly. Into this relaxed atmosphere came Rogers. And Rogers was upset. He said nervously and at random, "Excuse me, sir, but does anyone know what's become of the bathroom curtain?" Lombard's head went up with a jerk. "The bathroom curtain? What the devil do you mean, Rogers?" "It's gone, sir. Clean vanished. I was going round drawing all the curtains, and the one in the bathroom wasn't there any longer." Mr. Justice Wargrave asked, "Oh, was it there this morning?" "Oh, yes, sir." Bloor said, "Well, what kind of curtain was it?" "Scarlet oil silk, sir. It went with the scarlet tiles." Lombard said, "And it's gone?" "Gone, sir." They stared at each other. Bloor said heavily, "Well, after all, what of it? Well, it's mad, but so's everything else. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You can't kill anybody with an oilskin curtain. Forget about it." Rogers said, "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir." He went out, shutting the door behind him. Inside the room, the pall of fear had fallen anew. Again, surreptitiously, they watched each other. Dinner came, was eaten, and cleared away, a simple meal, mostly out of tins. Afterwards, in the living room, the strain was almost too great to be borne. At 9 o'clock, Emily Brent rose to her feet. She said, "I'm going to bed," Vera said. "I'll go to bed too." The two women went up the stairs, and Lombard and Bloor went with them. Standing at the top of the stairs, the two men watched the women go into their respective rooms and shut the doors. They heard the sound of 2 bolts being shot and the turning of 2 keys. Bloor said with a grin, "No need to tell them to lock their doors." Lombard said, "Well, they're all right for the night at any rate." He went down again, and the other followed him. The 4 men went to bed an hour later. They went up together. Rogers, from the dining room where he was setting the table for breakfast, saw them go up. He heard them pause on the landing above. Then the judge's voice spoke. "I need hardly advise you, gentlemen, to lock your doors." Bloor said, "And what's more, put a chair under the handle. There are ways of turning locks from the outside." Lombard murmured, "My dear Bloor, the trouble with you is you know too much." The judge said gravely, "Good night, gentlemen. May we all meet safely in the morning." Rogers came out of the dining room and slipped halfway up the stairs. He saw four figures pass through four doors and heard the turning of four locks and the shooting of four bolts. He nodded his head. "That's all right," he muttered. He went back into the dining room. Yes, everything was ready for the morning. His eye lingered on the centre plaque of looking-glass and the seven little china figures. A sudden grin transformed his face. He murmured, "I'll see no one plays tricks tonight, at any rate." Crossing the room, he locked the door to the pantry. Then, going through the other door to the hall, he pulled the door to, locked it, and slipped the key into his pocket. Then, extinguishing the lights, he hurried up the stairs and into his new bedroom. There was only one possible hiding place in it, the tall wardrobe, and he looked into that immediately. Then, locking and bolting the door, he prepared for bed. He said to himself, "No more Indian tricks tonight. I've seen to that." End of Disc 3. And then there were none. Disc 4. Chapter 11. Philip Lombard had the habit of waking at daybreak. He did so on this particular morning. He raised himself on an elbow and listened. The wind had somewhat abated but was still blowing. He could hear no sound of rain. At 8 o'clock the wind was blowing more strongly, but Lombard did not hear it. He was asleep again. At 9:30 he was sitting on the edge of his bed, looking at his watch. He put it to his ear. Then his lips drew back from his teeth in that curious wolf-like smile characteristic of the man. He said very softly, "I think the time has come to do something about this." At 9:25 he was tapping on the closed door of Bloor's room. The latter opened it cautiously. His hair was tousled, and his eyes were still dim with sleep. Philip Lombard said affably, "Sleeping the clock round? Well, shows you've got an easy conscience." Bloor said shortly, "What's the matter?" Lombard answered, "Anybody called you or brought you any tea? Do you know what time it is?" Bloor looked over his shoulder at the small travelling clock by his bedside. He said, 9:55? Wouldn't have believed I could have slept like that. Where's Rogers?" Philip Lombard said, "It's a case of echo answers where." "What do you mean?" asked the other sharply. Lombard said, "I mean that Rogers is missing. He isn't in his room or anywhere else, and there's no kettle on, and the kitchen fire isn't even lit." Bloor swore under his breath. He said, "Where the devil can he be? Out on the island somewhere? Wait till I get some clothes on. See if the others know anything." Philip Lombard nodded. He moved along the line of closed doors. He found Armstrong up and nearly dressed. Mr. Justice Wargrave, like Bloor, had to be roused from sleep. Vera Claythorne was dressed. Emily Brent's room was empty. The little party moved through the house. Roger's room, as Philip Lombard had already ascertained, was untenanted. The bed had been slept in, and his razor and sponge and soap were wet. Lombard said, "Well, he got up all right." Vera said in a low voice, which she tried to make firm and assured, "You don't think he's hiding somewhere? Waiting for us?" Lombard said, "My dear girl, I'm prepared to think anything of anyone. My advice is that we keep together until we find him." Armstrong said, "He must be out on the island somewhere." Bloor, who had joined them dressed but still unshaved, said, "Where's Miss Brent got to? That's another mystery." But as they arrived in the hall, Emily Brent came in through the front door. She had on a mackintosh. She said, "The sea is as high as ever. I shouldn't think any boat could put out today." Bloor said, "Have you been wandering about the island alone, Miss Brent? Don't you realise that that's an exceedingly foolish thing to do? Emily Brent said, I assure you, Mr. Blore, that I kept an extremely sharp lookout.
Blore grunted. He said,
Seen anything of Rogers?
Miss Brent's eyebrows rose.
Rogers? No, I haven't seen him this morning. Why?
Mr. Justice Wargrave, shaved, dressed, and with his false teeth in position, came down the stairs. He moved to the open dining-room door. He said,
Ah, laid the table for breakfast, I see.
Lombard said,
We might have done that last night.
They all moved inside the room, looking at the neatly set plates and cutlery, at the row of cups on the sideboard, at the felt mats placed ready for the coffee urn. It was Vera who saw it first. She caught the judge's arm, and the grip of her athletic fingers made the old gentleman wince. She cried out,
The Indians! Look!
There were only six china figures in the middle of the table. They found him shortly afterwards. He was in the little wash-house across the yard. He had been chopping sticks in preparation for lighting the kitchen fire. The small chopper was still in his hand. A bigger chopper, a heavy affair, was leaning against the door. The metal of it stained a dull brown. It corresponded only too well with the deep wound in the back of Roger's head.
Perfectly clear, said Armstrong. The murderer must have crept up behind him, swung the chopper once, and brought it down on his head as he was bending over.
Blore was busy on the handle of the chopper and the flour sifter from the kitchen. Mr. Justice Wargrave asked,
Would it have needed great force, Doctor?
Armstrong said gravely, A woman could have done it, if that's what you mean. He gave a quick glance round. Vera Claythorne and Emily Brent had retired to the kitchen. The girl could have done it easily. She's an athletic type. In appearance, Miss Brent is fragile-looking, but that type of woman has often a lot of wiry strength. And you must remember that anyone who's mentally unhinged has a good deal of unsuspected strength. The judge nodded thoughtfully. Blore rose from his knees with a sigh. He said,
No fingerprints. Handle was wiped afterwards.
A sound of laughter was heard. They turned sharply. Vera Claythorne was standing in the yard. She cried out in a high, shrill voice, shaken with wild bursts of laughter.
Do they keep bees on this island? Tell me that. Where do we go for honey?
They stared at her uncomprehendingly. It was as though the sane, well-balanced girl had gone mad before their eyes. She went on in that high, unnatural voice.
Don't stare like that, as though you thought I was mad. It's sane enough what I'm asking. Bees, hives, bees. Oh, don't you understand? Haven't you read that idiotic rhyme? It's up in all your bedrooms. Put there for you to study. We might have come straight away if we'd had any sense. Seven little Indian boys chopping up sticks. And the next verse. I know the whole thing by heart, I tell you. Six little Indian boys playing with a hive. And that's why I'm asking, do they keep bees on this island? Isn't it funny? Isn't it damn funny?
She began laughing wildly again. Dr. Armstrong strode forward. He raised his hand and struck her a flat blow on the cheek. She gasped, hiccuped, and swallowed. She stood motionless a minute. Then she said,
Thank you. I'm all right now.
Her voice was once more calm and controlled, the voice of the efficient games mistress. She turned and went across the yard into the kitchen, saying,
Miss Brent and I are getting you breakfast. Can you bring some sticks to light the fire?
The marks of the doctor's hand stood out red on her cheek. As she went into the kitchen, Blore said,
Well, you dealt with that all right, Doctor.
Armstrong said apologetically,
Had to. We can't cope with hysteria on top of everything else.
Philip Lombard said, She's not a hysterical type. Armstrong agreed.
Oh, no. Good, healthy, sensible girl.
Just the sudden shock. It might happen to anybody. Rogers had chopped a certain amount of firewood before he had been killed. They gathered it up and took it into the kitchen. Vera and Emily Brent were busy. Miss Brent was raking out the stove. Vera was cutting the rind off the bacon. Emily Brent said,
Thank you.
We'll be as quick as we can, say half an hour to three quarters. The kettle's got to boil.
Ex-Inspector Blore said in a low, hoarse voice to Philip Lombard,
"Know what I'm thinking."
Philip Lombard said, "Well, as you're just about to tell me, it's not worth the trouble of guessing."
Ex-Inspector Blore was an earnest man. A light touch was incomprehensible to him. He went on heavily. "There was a case in America. Old gentleman and his wife. Both killed with an axe. Middle of the morning. Nobody in the house but the daughter and the maid. Maid, it was proved, couldn't have done it. Daughter was a respectable middle-aged spinster. Seemed incredible. So incredible that they acquitted her. But they never found any other explanation." He paused. "I thought of that when I saw the axe, and then when I went into the kitchen and saw her there so neat and calm. Hadn't turned a hair. That girl coming over all hysterical, well, that's natural. Sort of thing you'd expect, don't you think so?"
Philip Lombard said laconically,
"Well, it might be."
Blore went on, "But the other, so neat and prim, wrapped up in that apron, Mrs. Rogers' apron, I suppose, saying, 'Breakfast will be ready in half an hour or so.' If you ask me, that woman's as mad as a hatter. Lots of elderly spinsters go that way. I don't mean going for homicide on the grand scale, but go queer in their heads. Unfortunately, it's taken her this way. Religious mania. Thinks she's God's instrument. Something of that kind. She sits in her room, you know, reading her Bible."
Philip Lombard sighed and said, "That's hardly proof positive of an unbalanced mentality, Blore."
But Blore went on ploddingly, perseveringly. "And then she was out in her mackintosh. Said she'd been down to look at the sea." The other shook his head. He said, "Rogers was killed as he was chopping firewood. That's to say, first thing, when he got up, the Brent woman wouldn't have needed to wander about outside for hours afterwards. If you ask me, the murderer of Rogers would take jolly good care to be rolled up in bed snoring."
Blore said, "You're missing the point, Mr. Lombard. If the woman was innocent, she'd be too dead scared to go wandering about by herself. She'd only do that if she knew that she had nothing to fear. That's to say, if she herself is the criminal."
Philip Lombard said, "Well, that's a good point. Yes, I hadn't thought of that." He added with a faint grin,
"Glad you don't still suspect me."
Blore said rather shamefacedly,
"I did start by thinking of you, that revolver, and the queer story you told, or didn't tell. But I've realised now that that was really a bit too obvious."
He paused and said, "Hope you feel the same about me."
Philip said thoughtfully,
"I may be wrong, of course, but I can't feel that you've got enough imagination for this job. All I can say is if you're the criminal, you're a damn fine actor, and I take my hat off to you."
He lowered his voice. "Just between ourselves, Blore, and taking into account that we'll probably both be a couple of stiffs before another day is out, you did indulge in that spot of perjury, I suppose?"
Blore shifted uneasily from one foot to the other. He said at last,
"Doesn't seem to make much odds now. Oh, well, here goes. Landor was innocent, right enough. The gang had got me squared, and between us, we got him put away for a stretch. Mind you, I wouldn't admit this if there were any witnesses," finished Lombard with a grin. "It's just between you and me. Well, I hope you made a tidy bit out of it."
"Oh, I didn't make what I should have done. Mean crowd, the Purcell gang."
"I got my promotion, though."
"And Landor got penal servitude and died in prison."
"Well, I couldn't know he was going to die, could I?" demanded Blore.
"No, that was your bad luck."
"Mine?"
"His, you mean."
"Yours, too. Because as a result of it, it looks as though your own life is going to be cut unpleasantly short."
"Me?" Blore stared at him.
"Do you think I'm going to go the way of Rogers and the rest of them? Not me. I'm watching out for myself pretty carefully, I can tell you."
Lombard said,
"Oh, well, I'm not a betting man. And anyway, if you were dead, I wouldn't get paid."
"Look here, Mr. Lombard.
What do you mean?"
Philip Lombard showed his teeth. He said,
I mean, my dear Blore, that in my opinion you haven't got a chance.
What?
Your lack of imagination is going to make you absolutely a sitting target. A criminal of the imagination of UN Owen can make rings round you any time he or she wants to.
Blore's face went crimson. He demanded angrily, "And what about you?"
Philip Lombard's face went hard and dangerous. He said, "I've a pretty good imagination of my own. I've been in tight places before now, and got out of them. I think, and I won't say any more than that, but I think I'll get out of this one."
The eggs were in the frying pan. Vera, at the stove, thought to herself, "Why did I make a hysterical fool of myself? That was a mistake. Keep calm, my girl, keep calm." After all, she'd always prided herself on her level-headedness. Miss Claythorne was wonderful, kept her head, started off swimming after Cyril at once. Why think of that now? All that was over. Over. Cyril had disappeared long before she got near the rock. She had felt the current take her, sweeping her out to sea. She had let herself go with it, swimming, quietly, floating, till the boat arrived, at last. They had praised her courage and her sang-froid, but not Hugo. Hugo had just looked at her. God, how it hurt, even now, to think of Hugo. Where was he? What was he doing? Was he engaged? Married?
Emily Brent said sharply,
"Vera, that bacon is burning! Oh, sorry, Miss Brent, so it is. How stupid of me."
Emily Brent lifted out the last egg from the sizzling fat.
Vera, putting fresh pieces of bacon in the frying pan, said curiously, "You're wonderfully calm, Miss Brent."
Emily Brent said, pressing her lips together,
"I was brought up to keep my head and never to make a fuss."
Vera thought mechanically, "Repressed as a child, that accounts for a lot." She said,
"Aren't you afraid?"
She paused and then added,
"Or don't you mind dying?"
Dying! It was as though a sharp little gimlet had run into the solid, congealed mass of Emily Brent's brain.
Dying? But she wasn't going to die. Well, the others would die, yes, but not she, Emily Brent. This girl didn't understand. Emily wasn't afraid, naturally. None of the Brents were afraid. All her people were service people. They faced death unflinchingly. They led upright lives, just as she, Emily Brent, had led an upright life. She had never done anything to be ashamed of. And so, naturally, she wasn't going to die.
The Lord is mindful of his own. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day. It was daylight now. There was no terror. We shall none of us leave this island.
Who had said that? Oh, General MacArthur, of course, whose cousin had married Elsie MacPherson. He hadn't seemed to care. He had seemed, actually, to welcome the idea. Wicked. Almost impious to feel that way. Some people thought so little of death they actually took their own lives. Beatrice Taylor!
Last night she had dreamed of Beatrice. Dreamt that she was outside, pressing her face against the window and moaning, asking to be let in, but Emily Brent hadn't wanted to let her in, because if she did, something terrible would happen. Emily came to herself with a start.
That girl was looking at her very strangely. She said in a brisk voice, "Everything's ready, isn't it? We'll take the breakfast in."
Breakfast was a curious meal. Everyone was very polite. "May I get you some more coffee, Miss Brent? Miss Claythorne, a slice of ham? Another piece of bacon?" 6 people, all outwardly self-possessed and normal. And within, thoughts that ran round in a circle like squirrels in a cage. What next? What next? Who? Which? Would it work, I wonder? It's worth trying, if there's time. My God, if there's time. Religious mania, that's the ticket. Looking at her, though, you can hardly believe it. Suppose I'm wrong. It's crazy. Everything's crazy. I'm going crazy. Wool disappearing, red silk curtains. It doesn't make sense. I can't get the hang of it. The damn fool. He believed every word I said to him. It was easy. I must be careful, though. Very careful. 6 of those little china figures. Only 6. But how many will there be tonight?
Who'll have the last egg?
Marmalade?
Oh, thanks. Can I give you some ham?
Six people, behaving normally at breakfast. Chapter 12. The meal was over. Mr. Justice Wargrave cleared his throat. He said in a small, authoritative voice,
"It would be advisable, I think, if we met to discuss the situation, shall we say, in half an hour's time, in the drawing-room?"
Everyone made a sound suggestive of agreement. Vera began to pile plates together. She said, "I'll clear away and wash up."
Philip Lombard said, "We'll bring the stuff out to the pantry for you."
"Thanks." Emily Brent, rising to her feet, sat down again. She said,
"Oh, dear."
The judge said,
"Anything the matter, Miss Brent?"
Emily said apologetically,
"I'm sorry. I'd like to help Miss Claythorne, but I don't know how it is. I feel just a little giddy."
"Giddy, eh?" Dr. Armstrong came towards her. "Quite natural. Delayed shock. I can give you something to—"
"No."
The word burst from her lips like an exploding shell. It took everyone aback. Dr. Armstrong flushed a deep red. There was no mistaking the fear and suspicion in her face. He said stiffly,
"Just as you please, Miss Brent."
She said,
"I don't wish to take anything at all. I will just sit here quietly till the giddiness passes off."
They finished clearing away the breakfast things. Bloor said,
"I'm a domestic sort of man. I'll give you a hand, Miss Claythorne."
Vera said, "Thank you." Emily Brent was left alone, sitting in the dining room. For a while she heard a faint murmur of voices from the pantry. The giddiness was passing. She felt drowsy now, as though she could easily go to sleep. There was a buzzing in her ears. Or was it a real buzzing in the room? She thought,
"It's like a bee. A bumblebee."
Presently she saw the bee. It was crawling up the window pane. Vera Claythorne had talked about bees this morning. Bees and honey. She liked honey. Honey in the comb, and strain it yourself through a muslin bag. Drip, drip, drip.
There was somebody in the room. Somebody all wet and dripping. Beatrice Taylor came from the river.
She had only to turn her head and she would see her.
But she couldn't turn her head. If she were to call out. But she couldn't call out. There was no one else in the house. She was all alone.
She heard footsteps. Soft, dragging footsteps coming up behind her. The stumbling footsteps of the drowned girl. There was a wet, dank smell in her nostrils. On the window pane the bee was buzzing, buzzing. And then she felt the prick. The bee sting on the side of her neck. In the drawing-room, they were waiting for Emily Brent. Vera Claythorne said, "Shall I go and fetch her?" Bloor said quickly, "Just a minute." Vera sat down again. Everyone looked inquiringly at Bloor. He said,
"Look here, everybody. My opinion's this. We needn't look farther for the author of these deaths than the dining-room at this minute. I take my oath that woman's the one we're after."
Armstrong said,
"And the motive? Religious mania. What do you say, Doctor?"
Armstrong said, "Well, it's perfectly possible. I have nothing to say against it, but of course we've no proof." Vera said, "She was very odd in the kitchen when we were getting breakfast. Her eyes..." She shivered. Lombard said,
"You can't judge her by that. We're all a bit off our heads by now."
Bloor said,
"There's another thing. She's the only one who wouldn't give an explanation after that gramophone record. Why? Because she hadn't any to give."
Vera stirred in her chair. She said, "That's not quite true. She told me afterwards."
Wargrave said,
"What did she tell you, Miss Claythorne?"
Vera repeated the story of Beatrice Taylor. Mr. Justice Wargrave observed,
"A perfectly straightforward story. I personally should have no difficulty in accepting it. Tell me, Miss Claythorne, did she appear to be troubled by a sense of guilt or a feeling of remorse for her attitude in the matter?"
"None whatever," said Vera. "She was completely unmoved."
Bloor said,
Hearts as hard as flints, these righteous spinsters. Envy, mostly. Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "It is now 11:05. I think we should summon Miss Brent to join our conclave." Bloor said, "Well, aren't you going to take any action?" The judge said, "I fail to see what action we can take. Our suspicions are, at the moment, only suspicions. I will, however, ask Dr. Armstrong to observe Miss Brent's demeanour very carefully. Let us now go into the dining room." They found Emily Brent sitting in the chair in which they had left her. From behind, they saw nothing amiss, except that she did not seem to hear their entrance into the room. And then they saw her face, suffused with blood, with blue lips and staring eyes. Bloor said, "My God, she's dead." The small, quiet voice of Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "One more of us acquitted. Too late." Armstrong was bent over the dead woman. He sniffed the lips, shook his head, peered into the eyelids. Lombard said impatiently, "Well, how did she die, Doctor? She was all right when we left her here." Armstrong's attention was riveted on a mark on the right side of her neck. He said, "That's the mark of a hypodermic syringe." There was a buzzing sound from the window. Vera cried, "Look, a bee, a bumblebee. Remember what I said this morning?" Armstrong said grimly, "It wasn't that bee that stung her. A human hand held the syringe." The judge asked, "What poison was injected?" Armstrong answered, "At a guess, one of the cyanides, probably potassium cyanide, same as Anthony Marston. She must have died almost immediately by asphyxiation." Vera cried, "But that bee, it can't be coincidence," Lombard said grimly. "Oh, no. It isn't coincidence. It's our murderer's touch of local colour. He's a playful beast. Likes to stick to his damnable nursery jingle as closely as possible." For the first time, his voice was uneven. It was as though even his nerves, seasoned by a long career of hazards and dangerous undertakings, had given out at last. He said violently, "It's mad. Absolutely mad. We're all mad." The judge said calmly, "We have still, I hope, our reasoning powers. Did anyone bring a hypodermic syringe to this house?" Dr. Armstrong, straightening himself, said in a voice that was not too well assured, "Yes, I did." Four pairs of eyes fastened on him. He braced himself against the deep, hostile suspicion of those eyes. He said, "Always travel with one. Most doctors do." Mr. Justice Wargrave said calmly, "Quite so. Will you tell us, Doctor, where that syringe is now?" "In the suitcase in my room." Wargrave said, "We might, perhaps, verify that fact?" The five of them went upstairs, a silent procession. The contents of the suitcase were turned out on the floor. The hypodermic syringe was not there. Armstrong said violently, "Somebody must have taken it." There was silence in the room. Armstrong stood with his back to the window. Four pairs of eyes were on him, black with suspicion and accusation. He looked from Wargrave to Vera and repeated helplessly, weakly, "I tell you, someone must have taken it." Bloor was looking at Lombard, who returned his gaze. The judge said, "There are five of us here in this room. One of us is a murderer. The position is fraught with grave danger. Everything must be done in order to safeguard the four of us who are innocent. I will now ask you, Dr. Armstrong, what drugs you have in your possession." Armstrong replied, "I have a small medicine case here. You can examine it. You will find some sleeping stuff, Trianol and Sulfonol tablet, packet of bromide, bicarbonate of soda, aspirin, nothing else. I have no cyanide in my possession." The judge said, "I have myself some sleeping tablets, Sulfonol, I think they are. I presume they would be lethal if a sufficiently large dose were given. You, Mr. Lombard, have in your possession a revolver." Philip Lombard said sharply, What if I have?
Only this. I propose that the doctor's supply of drugs, my own sulfonol tablets, your revolver, and anything else of the nature of drugs or firearms should be collected together and placed in a safe place. That after this is done, we should each of us submit to a search, both of our persons and of our effects.
Lombard said, I'm damned if I'll give up my revolver.
Wargrave said sharply, Mr. Lombard, you are a very strongly built and powerful young man, but ex-Inspector Blore is also a man of powerful physique. I do not know what the outcome of a struggle between you would be, but I can tell you this. On Blore's side, assisting him to the best of our ability, will be myself, Dr. Armstrong, and Miss Claythorne. You will appreciate, therefore, that the odds against you, if you choose to resist, will be somewhat heavy.
Lombard threw his head back. His teeth showed in what was almost a snarl.
Oh, very well, then, since you've got it all taped out.
Mr. Justice Wargrave nodded his head. You are a sensible young man. Where is this revolver of yours?
In the drawer of the table by my bed.
Good. I'll fetch it. I think it would be desirable if we went with you. Philip said with a smile that was nearer a snarl.
Suspicious devil, aren't you?
They went along the corridor to Lombard's room. Philip strode across to the bed table and jerked open the drawer. Then he recoiled with an oath. The drawer of the bed table was empty.
Satisfied? Asked Lombard.
He had stripped the skin, and he and his room had been meticulously searched by the other three men. Vera Claythorne was outside in the corridor. The search proceeded methodically. In turn, Armstrong, the judge, and Blore submitted to the same test. The four men emerged from Blore's room and approached Vera. It was the judge who spoke.
I hope you will understand, Miss Claythorne, that we can make no exceptions. That revolver must be found. You have, I presume, a bathing dress with you?
Vera nodded.
Then I will ask you to go into your room and put it on, and then come out to us here.
Vera went into her room and shut the door. She reappeared in under a minute, dressed in a tight-fitting, silk-rucked bathing dress. Wargrave nodded approval.
Thank you, Miss Claythorne. Now, if you will remain here, we will search your room.
Vera waited patiently in the corridor until they emerged. Then she went in, dressed, and came out to where they were waiting. The judge said,
We are now assured of one thing. There are no lethal weapons or drugs in the possession of any of us five. That is one point to the good. We will now place the drugs in a safe place. There is, I think, a silver chest, is there not, in the pantry?
Blore said, Well, that's all very well, but who's to have the key? You, I suppose. Mr. Justice Wargrave made no reply. He went down to the pantry, and the others followed him. There was a small case there designed for the purpose of holding silver and plate. By the judge's directions, the various drugs were placed in this, and it was locked. Then, still on Wargrave's instructions, the chest was lifted into the plate cupboard, and this in turn was locked. The judge then gave the key of the chest to Philip Lombard, and the key of the cupboard to Blore. He said,
You two are the strongest physically. It would be difficult for either of you to get the key from the other. It would be impossible for any of us three to do so. To break open the cupboard or the plate chest would be a noisy and cumbrous proceeding, and one which could hardly be carried out without attention being attracted to what was going on.
He paused, then went on,
We are still faced by one very grave problem. What has become of Mr. Lombard's revolver?
Blore said,
Seems to me its owner is the most likely person to know that.
A white dint showed in Philip Lombard's nostrils. He said,
You damn pig-headed fool, I tell you it's been stolen from me.
Wargrave asked,
When did you see it last?
Well, last night. It was in the drawer when I went to bed. "'Ready in case anything happened.' "'The judge nodded. "'He said,
"'It must have been taken this morning, "'during the confusion of searching for Rogers, "'or after his dead body was discovered.
Vera said, "It must be hidden somewhere about the house. We must look for it." Mr. Justice Wargrave's finger was stroking his chin. He said, "I doubt if our search will result in anything. Our murderer has had plenty of time to devise a hiding place. I do not fancy we shall find that revolver easily." Blore said forcefully, "I don't know where the revolver is, but I'll bet I know where something else is. That hypodermic syringe. Follow me." He opened the front door and led the way round the house. A little distance away from the dining-room window, he found the syringe. Beside it was a smashed china figure. A sixth broken Indian boy. Blore said in a satisfied voice, "Only place it could be. After he'd killed her, he opened the window and threw out the syringe and picked up the china figure from the table and followed on with that." There were no prints on the syringe. It had been carefully wiped. Vera said in a determined voice, "Now, let us look for the revolver." Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "By all means, but in doing so, let us be careful to keep together. Remember, if we separate, the murderer gets his chance." They searched the house carefully from attic to cellars, but without result. The revolver was still missing. Chapter 13. "One of us. One of us. One of us." Three words, endlessly repeated, dinning themselves hour after hour into receptive brains. Five people. Five frightened people. Five people who watched each other, who now hardly troubled to hide their state of nervous tension. There was little pretense now, no formal veneer of conversation. They were five enemies, linked together by a mutual instinct of self-preservation. All of them suddenly looked less like human beings. They were reverted to more bestial types. Like a wary old tortoise, Mr. Justice Wargrave sat hunched up, his body motionless, his eyes keen and alert. Ex-Inspector Blore looked coarser and clumsier in build. His walk was that of a slow, padding animal. His eyes were bloodshot. There was a look of mingled ferocity and stupidity about him. He was like a beast at bay, ready to charge its pursuers. Philip Lombard's senses seemed heightened rather than diminished. His ears reacted to the slightest sound. His step was lighter and quicker. His body was lithe and graceful, and he smiled often, his lips curling back from his long white teeth. Vera Claythorne was very quiet. She sat most of the time huddled in a chair. Her eyes stared ahead of her into space. She looked dazed. She was like a bird that has dashed its head against glass and that has been picked up by a human hand. It crouches there, terrified, unable to move, hoping to save itself by its immobility. Armstrong was in a pitiable condition of nerves. He twitched and his hands shook. He lighted cigarette after cigarette and stubbed them out almost immediately. The forced inaction of their position seemed to gall him more than the others. Every now and then he broke out into a torrent of nervous speech. We shouldn't just sit here doing nothing. There must be something, surely. Surely there's something we can do. If we lit a bonfire," Law said heavily. "In this weather?" The rain was pouring down again. The wind came in fitful gusts. The depressing sound of the pattering rain nearly drove them mad. By tacit consent, they had adopted a plan of campaign. They all sat in the big drawing-room. Only one person left the room at a time. The other four waited till the fifth returned. Lombard said, "It's only a question of time. The weather will clear, then we can do something. Signal, light fires, make a raft, something." Armstrong said with a sudden cackle of laughter, "Question of time, time. We can't afford time. We shall all be dead." Mr. Justice Wargrave said, and his small, clear voice was heavy with passionate determination, "Not if we are careful. We must be very careful." The midday meal had been duly eaten, but there had been no conventional formality about it. All five of them had gone to the kitchen. In the larder, they had found a great store of tinned foods. They had opened a tin of tongue and two tins of fruit. They had eaten standing round the kitchen table. Then, herding close together, they had returned to the drawing-room to sit there. Sit, watching each other. And by now, the thoughts that ran through their brains were abnormal, feverish,
diseased. It's Armstrong. I saw him looking at me sideways just then. His eyes are quite mad. Quite mad. Perhaps he isn't a doctor at all. Well, that's it, of course. He's a lunatic. Escaped from some doctor's house, pretending to be a doctor. It's true. Shall I tell them? Shall I scream out? No. It wouldn't do to put him on his guard. Besides, he can seem so sane. What time is it? Only 3:15. Oh, God. I shall go mad myself. Yes, it's Armstrong. He's watching me now. They won't get me. I can take care of myself. I've been in tight places before. Where the hell is that revolver? Who took it? Who's got it? Nobody's got it. We know that. We were all searched. Nobody can have it. But someone knows where it is. They're going mad. They'll all go mad. Afraid of death. We're all afraid of death. I'm afraid of death. Yes, but that doesn't stop death coming. The hearse is at the door, sir. Where did I read that? The girl. I'll watch the girl. Yes. I'll watch the girl. 4:40. Only 4:40. Perhaps the clock has stopped. I don't understand. No, I don't understand. This sort of thing can't happen. It is happening. Why didn't we wake up? Wake up. Judgment Day, not... Not that. If I could only think. My head. Something's happening in my head. It's going to burst. It's going to split. This sort of thing can't happen. What's the time? Oh, God, it's only 4:45. I must keep my head. I must keep my head. If only I keep my head. It's all perfectly clear. All worked out. But nobody must suspect. It may do the trick. It must. Which one? That's the question. Which one? I think... Yes. I rather think... Yes. Him. When the clock struck 5, they all jumped. Vera said, "Does anyone want tea?" There was a moment's silence. Blaw said, "I'd like a cup." Vera rose. She said, "I'll go and make it. You can all stay here." Mr. Justice Wargrave said gently, "I think, my dear young lady, we would all prefer to come and watch you make it." Vera stared, then gave a short, rather hysterical laugh. She said, "Of course you would." 5 people went into the kitchen. Tea was made and drunk by Vera and Blaw. The other 3 had whiskey, opening a fresh bottle, and using a siphon from a nailed-up case. The judge murmured with a reptilian smile, "We must be very careful." They went back again to the drawing-room. Although it was summer, the room was dark. Lombard switched on the lights, but they did not come on. He said, "Of course. The engine's not been run today, since Rogers hasn't been there to see to it." He hesitated and said, "Oh, we could go out and get it going, I suppose." Mr. Justice Wargrave said, "There are packets of candles in the larder. I saw them. Better use those." Lombard went out. The other 4 sat watching each other. He came back with a box of candles and a pile of saucers. 5 candles were lit and placed about the room. The time was 4:45.